I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope, gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our PennSound archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Joseph Uris Algazin, a Buffalo-based poet whose work has appeared in Forage and the Robert Walzer Society of Western Massachusetts, whose last project, Towards Days, can be read on his blog, which runs under the title Lean To. And by Bob Perlman, whose first book of poems was Braille, 1975, and most recent is If Life, 2006, whose critical writing includes the marginalization of poetry, and whose PennSound page includes recordings from many, many occasions, the earliest dated March 78, and the most recent October 2009 here at the Writer's House. And by Jenna Osman, whose books of poems include an essay in Asterisks and The Character, and earlier, Jury and 12 Parts, who appeared in Good Company in the 2002 Best American Poetry selected by Robert Creeley, and who, with Juliana Spahr, co-founded and co-edited the great literary magazine Chain, and who at Temple University has occasionally taught a course called Documentary Poetics. Hello, all three of you. Welcome back to Poem Talk, Bob.
Hello, hello.
And welcome back to the Writer's House and to Poem Talk for the first time, Jenna and Joey. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Well, today we're here to do the impossible, to talk for 20 minutes or so about a sprawling, super ambitious, and yet in some ways super modest work that consists of 100 cards.
500
cards stacked inside a box. Thank you, Bob. It's Robert Grenier's extremely influential Sentences. The work is meant, it would seem, to be looked at, sorted through, but Grenier at least several times had no qualms about performing the piece aloud. PennSound has two such recordings. One is a brief reading done with Charles Bernstein in 2006, and the other was a fairly lengthy performance of Sentences done at St. Mark's Poetry Project in New York on April 8, 1981. To focus the discussion a little, we're going to listen to two excerpts from the 81 St. Mark's reading. And just so we have an oral marker for the end of the first excerpt and start of the second, I'll note that the second begins with the card that reads, Concepts, They See Us. So here now is Robert Grenier performing Sentences.
12 vowels. Breakfast, the sky flurries. 12 vowels. Paw barks from experience. Bird, I wonder if I do. Bird, I wonder if I do. Cookies over Lake Superior. Corroborative mountainous panorama. Joe. So I try to think in relation to what a voice could be. Here, particularly as I could imagine what it might sound like that way. But then I don't know. You say you put them on the page, and the voice would tend to go off to the right and left. But then again, if you dramatize that, that becomes that voice. So standing over backward. I don't mind cars at night. Two clear nights without rain. Who wants to, loves to, does. Mosquitoes nigh in old age reflexes, chip. Previously leaves were red. Concepts, they see us. Happy without worry over cars. South on Monday and sleep over. Thoughtful in extremities. Christmas Eve, I sat in the kitchen and talked. Someone than someone. Elms back of vats. A bush is moving and the airplane flying past. Looking at boughs. The thugs. Who are you talking on the telephone to? Sunlight, snow in the air, dust in the room. Amy, me, how fast I turned around and went up. All the more so if she's sleeping, that's a steady rate or steady place if I'll sleep. Refrigerator so long. Good dog face, good dog face. Crabby. Two trees. More birds, whereas I should if I were there, I would. Trouble with chess is it doesn't make any noise. You see, these don't run in a sequence, and so what's sort of, they follow after each other. It's autumn, frogs for the first time since autumn. Amy, the day after tomorrow in that night is gonna be. The day after tomorrow in that night is gonna be.
So let's just start. I know we're gonna wander off into all kinds of talk about this, but why don't we start at least with taking one of the cards and talking about it. So how about Bird, I Wonder If I Do, which he feels the need to repeat. Is there anything anybody wants to say about that? Bird, I Wonder If I Do.
I think a really interesting thing that you can find on Penn Sound is that interview between Grenier and Charles Bernstein from Close Listening, where they discuss that card in particular, and he basically whistles the sound that he has. It's not so much that he's transcribed it, but rather than like setting words to music, he's set the music to words.
Bird sound.
Yeah. So I was really kind of startled by that when he whistled the sound of it.
And so why would he, Joey, why would he do it twice for in the performance?
Well,
is that to signal that words are not going to quite do the bird sound, and so he might as well do it arbitrarily?
Well, I think it's something, I think it's something kind of difficult in the form itself of the sentences of the box or the cards, and it's something that he says in the same interview with Charles Bernstein about his reluctance or his move away from speech patterns necessarily and not needing to repeat or not needing to speak the words out loud. And so when I always hear him repeating them twice, it almost feels as though he's reapproaching it and trying to find a way to speak the sentence.
I also think that this is like a very odd piece to have a program about. We were talking earlier how we're talking about a piece that has this physical presence, it's this box with 500 cards, very much about kind of taking the text in on the page space. And that's what the reader does, is repeats, you know, the card makes you not just read it once. You kind of spend time with it. He wants to stop time, yeah. You know. And but then we have him reading these cards, so there's a performance of him.
Which was already something of a problem.
Right, and now we have a recording of him read, so we don't even have the visual of him going through the cards. So it's kind of so removed from the kind of originating.
Removed in one way, but Bob, isn't it coming back to it by allowing him orally to do the bird sound? You know, I do think that we are far away, further away from the original innovation, but in some ways the performance, he says, takes such joy in the performance, especially with Charles, where he just whistles it as if to reduce it back to sound, which you couldn't do in the box. I don't know. Bob?
Oh, Grenier always brings up the most fundamental poetic paradoxes so briskly. I Wonder If I Do, you could say that it's trying to mime nature, an impulse going back to pound ideograms, the Chinese ideogram, flamingo, rose, iron rust, sunrise, that is trying to do away with the abstraction of Western language. On the other hand, there's Grenier, who also writes I Hate Speech, wants to get at the word quality of the of what he's writing, the word way back in the head. I would say, rather than trying to get it right when he repeats, I think he's trying to take it, defamiliarize it, even while he's saying, you know, it's a very fairly obvious kind of language. But he repeats it the second time quizzically, something like, "Can't you hear this as a non-human quizzicality? I wonder if this is English. I wonder if I do make sense. I wonder if we are human." That kind of impulse, which is certainly magnified in his later work, where he tries to defamiliarize the most common words, every one of the letters.
And to take that a little further, this idea of, and I agree with you that it's not a transcription of nature or a miming of nature, but what I'm interested in with Grenier, it's another thing that he wrote about in Hedge Crickets Sing. I think it's in the fifth issue of Language magazine, and he talks about how experience of objects or experience of birdsong can bring one to writing. As writing moves towards objects, it brings the person who is writing the object along with them. And so I like to see not so much a call and response, but almost not quite simultaneity, but a relationship between, say, the birdsong and the poem itself, gesturing almost towards each other.
Janet, it's sort of, in some ways, it is a paradox here, it's both things at once. In some ways, he's getting away from literary tradition by, I don't know, just listening really hard to the birds, almost like Stephen Snowman, you know, just whatever's out there in nature and then reproducing it with the materials he has at hand. But in another sense, it's very literary. I think of Shelley beginning with meter and sound and then adding words later. And when we get to something like autumn, frogs for the first time since autumn, I want to think non-literarily, but I can't help but thinking of the Japanese tradition of poetic condensation of a basho poem, even down to the frogs. There's something very literary about what he's doing. What's your impulse in hearing this or responding to it? Is it a literary impulse or a non-literary impulse?
Well, I think, Bob, you talked about the Elms card in that, through that perspective. Didn't you? And
you're looking quizzically, Bob.
In the marginalization chapter, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, these works are very much about attention. It's defamiliarization, but not just for the sake of making strange. It's really a decontextualization of what he calls the commonplace. So, again, to kind of slow down the way that you're approaching this everyday language and making you spend time with it and attend to it differently. And this is why I find it so difficult to make the leap from reading the words on the page to listening to him read them out loud, because I feel like the attention is completely different in performance than it is when you're on the page. Especially now, I've been thinking a lot lately about internet attention and how internet attention is so destructive of reading attention, of absorptive attention. And so here we are coming to this piece through the internet that is really, I think, essentially anti-internet attention. He's using the words that nobody would think worthy of spending more time with. Just things that people say, things that people around him say. And I think the purpose is to allow it to transform, to become something that he's recycling it in a way so that it can have a different kind of life.
I'm still actually a couple questions back, thinking about the performance, Grenier's performance, there really is a stand-up element to Grenier's performance. It's a funny kind of, it's like, what's the shortest Shaggy Dog story you can tell? You can tell when the audience laughs, you know, that's the trouble with chess is it doesn't make any noise. That's one of the longer ones, but Joe, you know, and
they love that. The crowd loved that. Why?
Yeah. It's
all caps, Joe, all caps, Joe.
Well, if
is
you
he
listen,
calling for Joe,
if you listen to it, there's the first one, he holds the O, Joe. And what's strange is that it's completely the same word, right? So there's this play. You can't see it with the title, right? But it's this expectation as you hold the Joe, and then you're just given the Joe. again, there's this very strange sort of moment that goes on.
But I think that this, I mean, I haven't actually seen him read this piece, but I imagine him, I mean, it's defying the expectation of what would follow one word, and then he follows it with the same word, and then he turns to the next card. I mean, wouldn't there be
very
something in that?
Very quickly sometimes to the next card.
Yeah, I mean, isn't there something in the punctuation of that turning to the next card that also leads to the pleasure that the audience has in response?
I'm thinking that the Joe is a site of a very micro literary polemic between Ron Silliman and myself, because in Ron's response to the marginalization of poetry at that Liddy symposium way back,
where he was somewhat critical of
my academic turn toward academia. One critique was that Joe, that I had sort of bowdlerized it in the presenting it on the page, and I hadn't given it the full seven spaces between the instantiations of Joe on the card, and so again we have a kind of almost the sacredness of print, or the sort of secular sacredness, the concentration of print, the isolation of print, and the sociality, shaggy dog sociality of Grenier's performance.
And Grenier has both of those impulses.
I'm saying both. Yeah.
But getting back to the performance of Joe and the stickiness in the circa 1981, you know, this is the first time I assume a lot of people in this audience heard Sentences. It was relatively new, and it was, you know, he performed it in New York, so everybody was there. And if you didn't know Grenier, you'd go and you'd be very, this is a very serious avant-garde moment, and we can, and you know, is it the way he delivers it that's just tickles you and makes you appreciate the pleasure, or is it the setup of this very important, you have a feeling as he's doing it that this is going to be a really important experiment, and he wants you to just celebrate it. Is there something, is it in the performance or in the setup? I mean, Cookies Over Lake Superior gets a big laugh. That's funny. Joe could be done in a very serious black turtleneck beret.
Stanislavski, you could have 50 different ways of, you know, tragic,
and I can
tragic
imagine
calling
dead
out
of silent serious taking notes on that one. Am I making too much of
no,
this?
No. I think the spaciousness of the minimalism allows for all sorts of possible social, you know, the emotions to rush in if you choose to read it that way. There's nothing to keep them out, you know.
I this conversation is having me reconsider my feelings about listening to them being performed, the recording, which I was kind of resisting a bit. I think that there is, like you said, a kind of attitude towards the work in print. Everybody who writes about this piece apologizes for not being able to reproduce it as it originally was. And there's even, I think, Jeff Huth, is that how you say his name? H-U-T-H? Jeff Huth. He kind of explains a reading of the work. He actually got a copy of the box and how he kept it in the order of the cards. That,
ah, you know, that's there's a, like a fundamental, a fundamental of, misapprehension.
Well, you know, no, I
because
think...
Because Grenier didn't really
there
want
is
us
no
to
order.
Worry
there
about
There is
the
no
order.
Order.
I don't think that he... I think he knew that, absolutely, uh-huh. that they're to be shuffled, and yet there is this kind of resistance to changing the piece as it is given to you. In any case, I think in the recording, there can be... I think there's humor when you're reading the cards as well, but I think that
maybe
that
more
kind
so
of...
than when you're fetishizing this incredibly beautiful box. I mean, I think when I hear about the box, I see pictures. Bob Perlman here owns a box. He didn't bring it with him. And we will put an image of the original, a photo of one of the original boxes on the Poem Talk website. And bibliographical note, Whale Cloth edition, there's a Whale Cloth edition at whalecloth.org, which is reproduced as best it can be done on the web. But
differently with the order different each time.
With the order different each time. But when I look at the box, I think of Duchamp with, you know, taking real care to make these boxes. Well, but that's a fetishization, maybe an ironic
you know
version
what, though?
Of it. And this seems to me not.
You know, though, the box, I mean, there is this, there is a literary historical polemic in the form of this. I mean, it really is pushing beyond pieces.
When you say pieces, you mean Creeley's
Robert
pieces?
Creeley's pieces, where you had the play between a quote-unquote complete poem that was marked by three dots and then a little section marked by a single dot. And in pieces, there wasn't much difference between the little pieces and the bigger pieces, and clearly it was gesturing toward a all-over module kind of production. And Grenier took it a step farther and went beyond the book format, went beyond the sequential format, and really emphasized the fungibility, modularity, minimalism, anti-narrativism, but keeping a profound concentration on textuality. I think all that there is in the form of the cards.
He says at one point in the reading, you can increase the duration of these if you attend to them longer, which is this kind of beautiful tautology that he builds. But there is an incredible amount of stickiness to what he's doing, but there's an incredible amount of seriousness.
Well, in the performance, I mean, he has a sense of humor, and I think he brings to all of his readings, and he certainly does it in the later readings, the one he did here at the Writer's House, but he does it all the time. You know, it's a rubbing his head, and what can this possibly mean, and the hyper-quizzical quality of like, oh my.
And then slaying us with the delay of the talk, meta-talk about the work, and then every once in a while, maybe 20 minutes go by, and then you get another poem, another piece, then more talk, and it's at the point where you realize this is a very carefully, well, improvised in the detail, but overall it's a planned out thing that he's going to drag it out and stretch the time between the text and the meta text. And I find that the performance, the oral performance here, is a different work, but it's commensurate with the experiment of the box, because he can't otherwise produce the box. Does it make any sense? I mean, I find the performance frustrating, but I understand what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, you know, if you allow this sort of like 12 vowels, breakfast, the sky, flurries, I mean, it asks to be counted, right? It has to be returned to, and the vowels to be counted and to
which
notice.
Which you can't do when you're hearing him read that.
Yeah, so he's like forced into this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pace of syntax itself. You can't see how he's, you know, swinging the sense with the line break, you know, and what the weird space between the lines are. You can't tell if it's, you know, 7 or 22 lines between Joe and Joe. Mm-hmm.
Does anybody ever want to read the box, the cards in the box, novelistically? I get to know Amy. I care about what's happening at the Grenier household. Characters develop,
well, you know,
arbitrarily and out of order.
You know, I mean, I actually say that about Ron's Silliman's New Sentences, I was talking about the work What, on a larger scale it works too, that there is something about these basically lifelong projects of disjunction and anti-narrative work that ultimately become they become a species of novel for the caring, contextualizing reader.
Jenna?
I
don't agree.
Don't agree, I think. I mean, it's something that I...
caring about Amy or
no,
about reading
that
novelistically?
It's working novelistically, that it turns out to be a kind of autobiographically linked project. It's something that confuses me a little bit about him, because you know, he'll say, "Oh, this is about the time when
he's." Well, to go back to listening to the birds, first example. I wonder if I do. I mean, that is ultimately the root of that literary artifact, is the experience of Grenier.
Right, and what does it mean to kind of to give that information when ultimately it seems completely irrelevant to me? The story, if there is one, is between the letters that are on the page, that are between the words on the page, how they're kind of calling attention to something that's very familiar, but in the ear of the reader, or in the eye of the reader, in the case of looking
well, these
at
are
cards.
Self-sufficient formally, definitely. But I think there is a sort of a humorous, impish, anti-formal, paratextual surround that maybe you can hear in Grenier's humor, and you can.
But
you know,
you can
ignore that if you want, or you can say that that's not the point.
But isn't, I mean, getting back to the I hate speech moment, isn't that kind of not only speaking against, you know, I hate not paying attention to language as such, but also, you know, rejecting the idea of the voice as subject.
And it's using the Poundian all caps shouting at the reader. It's a speech act. I hate speech. I mean, it's in caps. So
He doesn't mean it.
So he does mean it, but he... But there's this impish paratextual contradictor.
Joey, you were going to say something, but I want to interrupt and ask you a question, and you can ignore it too if you want. You love this work, and you, I imagine in your heart of hearts, at your quietest moments, you see a card and you like it, and you just, that's a good one. That's a little too easy. That one's too obvious. Oh, I like the subtlety of that one. Are we supposed to, is there valuation associated with the different cards? I mean, I'll just throw out the Cookies Over Lake Superior is a cheap laugh. It's just standard imagistic juxtaposition gone awry. Ha ha. And I like it. But I'd rather have the other ones, you know. Do you, I'm baiting you a little bit, but
well,
do you, are we supposed to, is there valuation supposed to go on?
I think one of the difficulties in that is the physical appearance with the box and with the type, where it's, I forget the name of the font that he was using. It doesn't matter.
It's like some kind of courier.
Yeah. I think it was like IBM Selectrix or something, right? And so they all look very, very similar. But when you start going through all 500 of them, they are doing some radically different
things.
Yeah. There's some that aren't even words. Or I think there's one that there's D's just splayed out on the card that comes this kind of like, you know, Augusto G. Campos, like a concrete poem. That's just sitting in there, which doesn't seem to fit with this other sort of very, as we've kind of been talking about, maybe domestic or throwaway words, right? But just kind of really
celebration of young Amy learning to speak,
right?
You know, some of that kind
bits of household conversation.
So there's all of these different moves, and I think that he keeps it various enough that our tendency to fix on wondering whether or not that one suffices, because there's 500 of them. Right, and they all sort of sit in that network of the 500, and so it takes, in a weird way, puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the individual card as you're experiencing it, and then taking away that pressure as well as it sits within that network. And so, as you start to isolate it and remove it, you know, in different contexts, then I think you can say, "I have a liking for this," which is really subjective and really wonderful that you are able to say, like walking down Washington Avenue, like every city has a Washington Avenue, and I remember the first time I was walking down Washington Avenue in Madison, Wisconsin, and I realized I'm walking down Washington Avenue, And I just, you know, you repeat it to yourself and you have an experience with it, and that poem has sort of that strange existence.
Until you come to Philadelphia and walk down Washington Avenue.
Get hit by a trolley.
That's right.
We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So who wants to gather some paradise?
Great book. I'm in the midst of Matthew Kirschenbaum's Mechanisms. That's a wonderful detailing of what materiality means in when writing with computers.
I want to say there's a new journal that just came out in its first issue called Wild Orchids, which is a critical journal based around a single author for each issue, but each piece quickly becomes a creative critical piece. And the first issue was based around Melville, and I know the next one they're going to be working on Hanna Wiener. So, and that's coming out of Buffalo.
Thank you. Well, that's all the Cookies Over Lake Superior we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Joey Yuris Algazin, Jana Osman, and Bob Perlman, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, the very same Steve McLaughlin, and a special shout-out to Steve, too, for carefully editing the two Grenier excerpts. Next time on Poem Talk, Jessica Lowenthal, Marcella Durand, and Jennifer Scapitone join me to talk about The Loaded Gun of Susan Howe's Emily Dickinson. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another Poem Talk.